ouviu buzina, não parou. Porém o lobo insiste e faz cara de triste. Chapeuzinho ouviu os conselhos da vovó, dizer que não pra lobo só.
Lobo Bobo, The Big Bad Wolf, by Carlos Lyra and Paul Winter. And just before that was Wolf Cry by Maria Villaboy. So, indeed, that's why I have it. I have Joe Donnelly on the phone. Hi, Joe.
Hey, how are you?
Well, very good. Thank you, Joe. And thank you so much for being on KOWS. And very interesting, Joe. You just did this major article about our very own OR7, the one Californian wolf. We've just got one. I mean, there's thousands all over the place. How comes California's only got one?
Well, you know, he came a long way to get here, too. he came a long way. He came from northeast Oregon, where wolves had crossed the Snake River and started establishing packs and territories about... They started doing that in earnest about 2008. You know, this is young wolves with alpha male tendencies tend to disperse to try and establish their own territories and packs, which is good for the species. But our friend OR7, who has earned the moniker Journey to his legion of internet fans, really, really traveled far. He traveled, I think, about 800 or 900 miles as the crow flies from northeast Oregon into Plumas and Lassen counties, where he spent most of his time, and a little bit into Hama County while he was in California. And he has since, after spending, more than a year, about, I think, 15 months in California, this spring he crossed back over into the border and is now in southern Oregon, last I checked, which is basically a pattern he followed before entering California back in December 2011. So he may be a lone wolf with the largest wolf territory on Earth right now. And why he came here is simply to look for a mate and to establish his own territory. But somehow he got on the road and he had hot feet and he just kept going, you know? So no one can really say why he's traveled so far. Wolves have been known to travel great distances,
but nothing like that, really. What is like the normal roaming for them?
Yeah, well, you know, it depends on the density of the wolf population, where they may be. But you know, a dispersing wolf will, you know, often establish a new territory 30-60 miles away from his pack. OR7 is hundreds of miles away from his pack, and it's a puzzle. I've asked biologists what he's doing, and they're sort of as perplexed as anybody. But Karen Kovacs with the California Fish and Game, I believe it's California Fish and Wildlife Service now, they changed their name, but she said, "Well, you were young once. What was on your mind?" And it's basically adventure and and meeting women. What he's trying to do.
Thing is, he doesn't know there isn't any, but we do.
Yeah, and I guess hope springs eternal for him. I often wonder if, you know, I think in my piece I sort of point out at some point, you know, a young man's quest, his romantic quest, sort of turns into, as the days go by and the years go by and the seasons go by, I should say, for him mostly, is turns into, you slowly slide into middle age, and at some point it might start to dawn on the poor guy that he's coming up empty, and now he's just, pretty soon he's just going to be a survivor. Every day a lone wolf survives is a victory, really. They they do much better in the safety and structure of a pack. A lone wolf is an anomaly in and of itself, but especially one that is dispersed this far is, as Karen Kovacs put it, a genetic dead end, meaning it's very unlikely he's going to reproduce. I just bummed the whole story out, and now it went from romantic to... No, I'm kidding. He may find love yet. No, he's not dead yet. He's still young enough.
They can fly one in by helicopter and drop it in, you know.
Well, you know, the romantic wolf lovers have asked for, why can't they bring a mate in for him, but... you know, no one's doing that. No one's going to do that. I don't think any wildlife services would tamper that much with what's going on in nature.
Playing God, I suppose, you know.
Yeah.
Let's just talk about you a bit. Now, you've had some incredible... can you tell us about your writing and some of the work you've done? Can you tell us how you got into writing and some of the places you've dropped down into?
Sure. That might be a more long and winding tale than even Journey went on. I got out of college and I was in New York in my post-college years. I guess I'll say when. It's about 1986. So yes, I'm old. I was just sort of knocking around in New York, not really knowing what I was going to do with my life. And I eventually just thought I'd rather try and figure that out in Colorado than in New York. And when I was about 26, I moved to Colorado and just sort of started ski bumming for a little while. And at the same time, I began writing for a local newspaper there called The Vail Trail. It was actually a really fun, cool, thick weekly newspaper that covered everything from, you know, small town type of stuff to actually important land use issues and environmental issues and things like that. And, I started covering music and art and film for them and ended up going to graduate school, UC Berkeley, UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. And that kind of set me off on my path as a journalist. And I was fortunate enough to have short stints at everywhere from the New York Daily News to the LA Times to the Washington Post. And after all that, I ended up back in Colorado again, back at the same paper. But I moved from the back of the paper to the front of the paper. So that was progress, I guess. And, eventually made my way to Los Angeles and did the snowboarding magazine and then worked for, a couple of other magazines and the LA Weekly. And then I started with Lori Ochoa. She was the editor at the LA Weekly when I was the deputy editor. Hmm. We started a fantastic journal called Slate Los Angeles, which was at least critically in terms of, some of the awards and recognitions we got for some of the work we did was very successful. It wasn't so successful financially, a big, thick, highly produced journal, 240 pages of long-form narrative and art and photography and everything else. So you can imagine how remunerative that was. but it was fun while it lasted. And, now here I am. I'm the executive editor of Mission and State, missionandstate.org, which is a narrative and investigative journalism website based in Santa Barbara.
Mm.
That's my thumbnail. Yeah.
Let people know your websites so they can check you out some more.
Sure. The website I'm the editor of is missionandstate.org, all one word. I think I have a very old personal website called joedonnellywrites.com where, there's some more of my writing, which includes a great tale of, not that it was written great, but it was a great tale of the largest tortoise airlift by the U.S. Army in history, called The Tortoise and the Tank. It's if you like this type of environmental writing that I did for Orion, that's a good one. And a lot of other fun things as well.
You have empathy with animals, obviously. What drew you to the wolf? How did that jump out at you as something to write a major article about?
Yeah, I think what happened was I saw a little, very short little news piece. I think it was in the LA Times about this wolf coming into California. And it was mentioned somewhere that it was the first wild wolf in California since, I think, 1924 when the last wolf was extirpated. And this wolf was actually kind of aiming in a direction, the vicinity of where the last wolf had actually been killed in Lassen County. And OR7 did end up spending a lot of time in that area. And it just struck me, the ironies were rich, of course. But also just felt to me like a very hopeful development. A lot of things going wrong in the world that you can read about all the time.
Right.
And, you know, and particularly, you know, environmentally, climate change, and, you know, politically, it just seems like up is down and left is right. And, you know, what should make perfect sense somehow doesn't. And, you know, the world seems upside down a lot of times. And right. this wolf coming in, this powerful symbol of wild nature, kind of insouciantly trotting into California, just I found it inspiring. And I think it resonated with me in a lot of ways. I've, for better or worse, I've kind of bucked the trends a lot in my own paths and my own career directions and own personal directions. And, you know, I think I might have related a little bit to his sort of romantic quest for a sense of himself. Who he was, what he's going to do. He's trying to establish himself, not just the territory, but himself. You know, I thought that was always a noble quest.
Yeah, you have that as your the imagery for you.
Yeah.
In the process, absolutely.
Yeah, as a writer, you know, it's pretty hard to turn away from that. What was interesting was how hard it was to get anyone interested in that story. I mean, on a publishing basis, but I was very thankful that such a quality magazine as Orion and a really great editor by the name of Andrew Bleckman sort of saw all those things that I was just talking about pretty immediately and went for it. You know, they took a chance on me. I didn't have any experience with them, and within these days of tamped down budgets all around, you know, there's not a lot of risk taking in you know, in this type of work, and so I applaud them for, you know, and Andrew for taking the chance.
There's so many, it's not just about one wolf. There's so many ramifications to that one wolf for the whole state that it's very important to bring it to people's attentions. And one of the things, obviously, is there's a lot of players involved in this one wolf. On the political side, obviously, there's people who like wolves environmentally, and then on the other side, farmers or whatever who don't like them. So who are the players, pro and con, in this battle?
Well, you can paint that the answer to that question in broad strokes, and you can get very specific with it as well. But you know, let's keep it pretty general. On the one side, you know, you have most conservationists, environmentalists, Friends of Wildlife, National Resources Defense Council, all those types of organizations. To them, the wolf is a canary in a coal mine. This you know, lone wolf. OR7 is carrying a lot on his back, and wherever he goes and wherever wolves continue to expand their territory out of the Northern Rockies, where there were gray wolves, where they were reintroduced in the mid-90s, they bring with them a lot of hopes for a different sort of, you know, to litigate how the West was won in a different way. The West was primarily won, you know, for ranchers and mineral extractors and loggers and railroaders, you know, all the sort of forces of manifest destiny. You know, the balance of political favors, even on public lands, has been tilted very much in their favor for a long time.
Right.
And, you know, so now those who would like to see the public lands and wilderness return or recapture as much of its natural state as possible, you know, OR7 carries a lot of their hopes and dreams on his back. At the same time, he also symbolizes a lot of the fears of some of those very same interests that I spoke about before. And even, you know, on a smaller level, even small ranchers and you know, even panhandlers and, you know, individual people in the West who still are sort of trying to eke an existence off the land.
Yeah.
And, you know, to them, the wolf symbolizes government interference in their way of life. They're afraid that with him will come a whole host of new regulations, like, you know, the spotted owl brought for logging or timber, you know, and they're just braced for, oh no, what's next? Because it's getting harder and harder, as we know, for a lot of, unless you're big agra or big oil, or big, you know, some very large mineral extractors, it's getting harder and harder to it can exist off the land. And, every new regulation can seem like it's another obstacle to doing that. I would argue, my argument might be that times are changing and, we have to change with them. And a lot of the environments that these wolves are coming into, for instance, in Northeast Oregon, there's a lot of folks, there's a lot of business that's coming, a lot of tourist dollars that come with actually coming to see the wolves, and it's giving another revenue stream to a lot of these communities, so there's that debate going on the ground in these places as well.
Interesting. So other forces are shifting, yes.
But, we've tried it without wolves for a long time, and it hasn't worked. Said as our relationship to wolves is how we treat wolves is how we treat nature to a large degree. And we've tried it without them for a long time, and it hasn't proved to be too effective. So it might be time to try something else.
They have been reintroduced, and people have been studying them and the effects of having them back. And I know I saw a documentary earlier this year at the Wild and Scenic Festival about Yellowstone and the wolves reintroduced back there, and the difference was remarkable. Can you address what happens when the wolves come back?
Sure. I think the en vogue phrase for that is the trophic cascade of benefits. Did you hear that bandied about at all? Or
vaguely sounds familiar. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But basically, the point of it is they've had enough time to, study the effects that wolves are having in Yellowstone and the environment. And this is even. We do have to say this is a short-term study. This has only been 20 years or so, 15 or 16 years. But it looks like, the wolves are having a tremendously positive effect on, the riparian areas in Yellowstone. Before wolves were reintroduced, the deer and elk would sort of lounge around in the riparian areas and chew up everything and eat everything like couch potatoes. And, the flora and fauna were sort of all out of balance. Wolves have come back and made the deer and elk be better deer and elk. They've had to move up higher. They can't laze around stomping down stream beds and eating all the foliage that used to provide some shade for the streams that, without the shade, oxygen levels have gone down and affecting fish, everything else. So wolves have come back and a lot of the bushes and shrubs have come back to riparian areas. Birds who hang around, ravens and other birds who hang around wolves and wolf kills, are actually spreading the berries that come off their fur. And, it's sort of like the land is coming back to life to a large degree. And, I think, the short conclusion is that wolves actually do a pretty good job of wilderness management, maybe better than we do. And and hunters complain that they're having a terrible effect on deer and elk populations, but statistics don't bear that out at all. In fact, throughout Wyoming, Montana, and Idaho, in all but a very couple of handful of game management districts in Idaho, the numbers are actually up. So. It's interesting.
Totally belies all the fears, basically.
Yeah, it's harder to hunt. You actually have to, go hunt, I guess.
Not just sit there and wait for them to come to you, yeah.
Yeah, if I was a sportsman in that way, I think I would appreciate the challenge.
Yes, I would think so. It has to be a sport.
Yeah. On the other hand, the hunting of wolves that has, started in the last 2 years since federal protections for gray wolves have been lifted in, is another issue, and that's a sort of an upsetting trend. And I think out of about 2,000 gray wolves that have spread throughout the Northern Rockies and into Oregon and Washington State, the numbers are down to about 1,100 or so now, I think. So hunting is having a really bad effect on the population.
Right. We're speaking to Joe Donnelly, who's written a fascinating article in the latest Orion magazine about our very own lone wolf, OR7, wandering around in Northern California and Oregon. You mentioned in your article, it's interesting, you join really the wolves and the Native Americans together, their fates. That's interesting. Could you elucidate on that?
Sure. I mean, my small thesis there is, that they're both victims of manifest destiny. They got in the way. Their land use issues, and they were in the way. Mm. And, they're... Both were, all but eradicated from the, contiguous lower 48 around the same time. Not exactly at the same time, but certainly overlapping. But by the turn of the century in 1930s, most of the wolves were gone, and by then the Indian question was pretty much settled as well. Forced into, refugee status in a few little pockets of land here and there. The wolves in, Upper Peninsula of Michigan and Minnesota, where a few holdouts remained, despite the extirpation program, and Native Americans on reservations here and there. And it's just, there's something powerfully symbolic about it. Wolves and man have been lockstep and throughout history. They've both been the most successful, as far as I know, at establishing domain. Mm. When they got in the way of manifest destiny here, they were dealt with ruthlessly.
Exactly. OR7, how do we know where he is? How is he tracked? How is he tagged? How is that done?
Well, he has a GPS collar. The OR7 refers to the seventh wolf collared in Oregon. Hmm. His parents are OR4 and OR2, if I'm recalling right. OR4 and OR2 were the... alpha male and alpha female of the Mnaha pack, which is an establishing pack in Wallowa County, Oregon, and so his progress is monitored by right now the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, because he's in Oregon, and they keep track of him. They don't post his general vicinity the way the California Department of Fish and Wildlife did when he's in California. They would post semi-regular updates as to the general vicinity, like western Plumas County or eastern Tehama County or southern Lassen County. That's about as specific as they would get. They didn't give daily. They didn't give daily updates because, of course, they want to protect OR7 from. Any crazies who might get an idea that he would be a good trophy.
Exactly. Unfortunately, you have to take those steps, yes.
Yeah, well, there's no reason to kill a wolf except for a trophy. I don't understand the hunting part of it. It serves no purpose for anything other than, ego or a trophy or something. I don't know what it's about. So, unfortunately, there are people who are motivated that way.
You went in your article. You did go in search of your subject to get close to him, and you went up to Northern California. Can you tell us about your search for OR7?
Well, sure. I mean, I didn't have any great expectations that we would cross paths, but I did. I did use the GPS. Postings on California Fish and Wildlife's homepage, and went into Plumas County, where he had been hanging around for a little while, and just started asking around and sniffing around, so to speak. forgive me. And some of the folks I talked to there who had been tracking his progress, in particular, a great reporter for one of the local newspapers, I believe his name is Michael Condon. Unfortunately, his section in the story hit the editing editing room floor. You know, he had been a former worked for the Forest Service and knew a lot about it. And his theory was that OR-7 was I hope I'm remembering this right, not putting words in his mouth, but I believe his theory was that the wolf was following the perimeter of the CHIPS fire, which had basically just been finally put under control by the time I got into the area, and it was in early September 2012. And, you know, I can imagine there was a lot of easy pickings for OR-7 hanging around the edges of the burn area of a pretty major fire. And, you know, wolves, they're opportunistic, and he's a lone wolf out trying to make it survive by himself. So, you know, he's going to go where the prey is easiest to go, or where the food source is easiest to get. And that was one theory of what he's doing. So, you know, I went there, and I ended up in this little tiny place called Belden Town, and had a kind of a funny, interesting inn on the river, and the North Fork of the Feather River. And, you know, the innkeeper told me about his dog having quite an episode, I think a few days before I arrived there, and he was positive the wolf was in the vicinity. He said his dog, who was a substantial dog, I forget, but a big dog and pretty calm and confident, was having quite an episode. So it felt a little like, you know, I was in American Werewolf in London or something, but, you know, stay off the moors and stuff. But, you know, I went out into the moors as much as, you know, I could in the time, because I was wasn't afraid of the wolf. Wolves don't attack humans. No, there's something a little spooky about it, and that was fun. And from there, you know, I kind of retraced a lot of his path down into California as I made my way up to Eureka, California, first of all, to go meet with Karen Kovacs, who's a wildlife manager for the northeastern counties of California, for the California Fish and Game, and then eventually ended up in a little bit later, went up to northeastern Oregon to see where he came from.
And you got pretty close to they knew where he was born.
Some ideas. Some of the folks who had been tracking the Imnaha pack and other Oregon wolves progress had a pretty good idea of where the pack was denning, I can't really say where we went, but I was taken to what was the denning area the previous summer, and it just if you get out there, you wonder why he would ever leave. It seems such a beautiful, wild, rugged place. And the gentleman who took me out, his name is Wally Sykes, and he's a wolf supporter and activist up there. I said, why would he leave? And, you know, he's very funny about it. He said, well, you know, wolves have ambitions. And he said, he thinks wolves have ambition. He said, you know, a land without wolves is a vacuum to a wolf, and a wolf will go into a vacuum to establish.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, now, it's interesting what you said just a bit earlier, is that wolves don't harm humans. That's people, I think, is that a misconception that they don't, that they do?
You know, I don't know. It's just part of mythology. It's part of, I guess it's just part of when you're kids, their stories are made up to spook you and to keep you close to home so you don't go wandering off in the woods and get lost. You know, I mean, I think the purpose of those stories are more to just try and encourage kids not to go wandering too far where they might get lost, not to get eaten by a wolf or anything else. But, if you go back far enough in history in the Middle Ages, there are some accounts of what were probably rabid wolves, taking a person here and there. But you can count the number of attacks on humans on one hand in modern times. It's just not, they're not interested. I went into a den full of wolves in Julian, California, the California Wolf Center. I knew, after I realized I wasn't going to actually get close to wild wolf, I did the next best thing and went into den where a pack of gray wolves are kept for educational purposes. And at the California Wolf Center, they also have Mexican gray wolves there that are breeding wolves for potentially to be returned to the wild. And, you know, they're very charismatic animals, and they seem gigantic, even though they're not. I mean, I remember going in and, you know, saying, my God, how big is that wolf? Like 120 pounds. And Aaron Hunt, who is the biologist in charge there, was like, no, that one's a female, about 70 pounds. Like, what? You know, they just have such presence. So then when you come across actually really, you know, a big one, more than 100 pounds, they seem outsized, but, you know, to what they really are. They occupy a large place in our imagination, and they're such charismatic, you know, magnificent animals. But, you know, even being in their environment, their habitat, I never felt afraid. I didn't feel threatened in the least. You know, I think, you know, unfortunately, because we have such a close kinship with dogs, more than anything, you might want to get closer to them than they care to have you get to them.
Right. And you know, I just was looking on the internet. I can and I see that there's like a bounty. You can buy a $19 tag, and you can go kill a wolf, it appears, up in Montana.
Yeah, and Idaho, probably in Wyoming, and unfortunately, we're even Minnesota and Wisconsin and Michigan, who have been living fairly harmoniously with wolves for a long time. I went back and looked at the numbers, the predation numbers in Minnesota over time, and the increase, even with the increase in wolf population there over time, and the predation numbers, you know, stayed the same. They didn't go up. There's been no increase in you know, livestock losses as the wolf population has increased. It's it's just absurd. This is the it's being sold as management, wildlife management, and it's quite unfortunate that the numbers don't bear out any reason to viciously hunt and trap these wolves.
When you have them being trapped like that, do they know, and do they move? Do they move their territories? How does that work? Or do they, like, hold on to the last in their territories?
You mean when they're being hunted? We'll see. It's just that it's a relatively, new phenomenon, both the reestablishment of wolf populations and now the hunting of them. It's just really been in the last couple of years. So I don't know the answer to that. I do know that one of the problems is that hunting them actually completely disrupts a very close-knit family and social structure. And, you know, when that happens, all kinds of pathologies follow. You can you disrupt the social structure and family structure of any population, and problems will follow. And, you know, my fear is that, you know, this is, sowing the seeds of what it's meant to, what it's ostensibly meant to prevent, which is, livestock depredation.
Right.
Wolves right now rank behind, I think, birds of prey in terms of their effect on livestock populations, and way behind domestic dogs.
Wow, really? Oh my goodness, really?
But once they start screwing up these families and, you know, killing the adults and having juveniles out on their own, and, you know, who haven't, you know, it's then it's, you know, the wolf, these young wolves are going to do anything they can to survive.
Just to survive,
and, and it's really a path of folly, and I should say it amazes me, but we don't seem to learn very well, we humans, from our mistakes, whereas animals tend to learn pretty well. So to answer your question, I think that the wolves will find a way to move away from trouble.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Joe. What a great article and insight into our into wolves and our very own little OR7 who is wandering around up in Northern California and Oregon. Yeah. What a lovely story, and thank you for bringing it to us. And let's hope that they keep coming back.
Yes, I hope so too, Arnold. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, I appreciate it so much, Joe. And do you want to give out email? Any people who are interested in helping wolves or any other ways they might want to look into it?
Yeah, I mean, there's. You can go online and just look up, Friends of Wolves or the National Resources Defense Council, Oregon Wild. You know, all kinds of. It doesn't take long for a lot of these sites to surface. But, I mean, I think, a good idea would be to lend as much support to Rob Clavins, C-L-A-V-I-N-S, and Oregon Wild as possible. They're really fighting the good fight for wolves in Oregon. And, the wolves are going to have to establish pretty successfully in Oregon before they start dispersing down into California. OR7 is probably way ahead of his time.
Oh, okay. Just getting us ready and aware.
Exactly, and he's had that effect. California is now moving towards listing gray wolves as an endangered species. So also petition California Fish and Wildlife Commissioners to go ahead with that and do list gray wolves as an endangered species in California, because they historically have been here and belong here.
Right, exactly. They were here and they should be here.
Thanks.
Well, thank you so much, Joe, for bringing this out to light. I appreciate the great work you've have done and keep doing.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Joe.